From the time we are young, women are surrounded by messaging that we should be skinnier, nicer, prettier, and less competitive. Messaging comes at us from all directions, and social media has only intensified that. Our sense of self-worth can be diminished from such an early age. But there are those women who, despite growing up in a world that may not encourage us, still reach for the stars, who are confident, strong, and achieving incredible things. Some of them wear suits, some wear gowns with tiaras, and some achieve it all in a pair of flip-flops. We want to hear their story so that women of all ages can be inspired to do things they may have never thought possible. It's time for Flip Flops and Tiaras. Today, we're talking to Jamila Sabir Wheaton. Jamila and I actually go way back. She was my best friend in high school and my number one ride or die. Jamila was tough and tenacious in high school. She was both hilarious and intimidating to some. She was a take-no-crap kind of chick. Because of those traits, she was really the last person I would have ever thought would end up enduring a physically violent relationship. But abusers come in very charming and disguising packages, and as you'll hear today, they take their time ensuring that they've worn you down, worn down your self-esteem, chipped away at your circle of friends, controlled so much of your world that by the time they do become violent, they have you seemingly trapped in their net. It's almost a grooming process, and it can truly happen to anyone. Jamila separates her life before the incident and after. She asked a relative once to describe what she was like before the abuse, and the response was caring, protective, accepting, loving, and funny as hell. She asked this question because she wanted to know if those traits would be different, if she was different, after going through this. Her relative assured her that she was, in fact, the same person with the same traits that made her so incredible. Jamila grew up in a web of drama without even realizing it. Her father committed suicide when she was just 11 years old, and a few years later, she was made aware that he was gay and that struggle at the time in the 80s might have contributed to his death. In high school, she befriended people who may have been considered misfits, but, well, that fit. After high school, she went to college, she met someone, she had a child, but after that relationship ended, she moved back to the East Coast, and she reconnected with someone from her childhood on social media. The relationship moved quickly. Their families were good friends, and it seemed like it was kind of what was meant to be. Even though red flags had started to surface, they became engaged very quickly. 1 year after her engagement, he beat her to the point that her skull was fractured, her face was hanging off, and she remembers thinking that she looked like Tina Turner in the scene from What's Love Got to Do with It. Jamila ended up moving into a new area after the attack to feel safer. When her granddaughter was born in 2016, she decided to put roots down and buy a house. 2 years later, she was laid off and sort of lost again. She took a leap of faith and she applied to Johns Hopkins and is currently getting her master's in nonfiction in their writing program. She now provides a home for her mother, her daughter, her granddaughter, and herself. Yes, she's still experiencing anxiety and trust issues, but she is getting better every day. Some of the content that you'll hear today is disturbing, so this does come with a warning that we're going to hear a fairly graphic description of what happened to Jamila. Hey, Jamila, welcome to Flip Flops and Tiaras.
Hello, everyone. Hello. Thank you for having me.
So it's myself and Dr. Harris. Jamila, you have a big story to tell, but I think let's back the train up a little bit. One of the things that's in this type of situation that you've gone through, it's kind of like what your history was like with regard to your father, but also just relationships that you had kind of through high school and when you were younger. Take us a little bit through some of the people you dated in the past and what those relationships were like, because I think one of the biggest things that people need to understand is there, at least from my perception, there wasn't any kind of history of you dating men that were potentially violent. Like, you dated normal, regular, awesome guys.
That's the funny thing. When I was thinking about this, I was looking back, and even the hood guys I dated, the ones who were involved in shady stuff, I never had anything abusive happen to me. In high school, you have the love of your lives every other week. This is going to be forever. Then the next month, it's like, no, this is going to be forever. Mm-hmm. But it was like regular, as you said. And you knew most of the guys I dated in high school. Like, nice boys next door. Even if they were screw-ups, they were still the boy next door. They were not violent. They were not verbally abusive. They were not anything like that. And even with my father, even though he committed suicide when I was 11, which I think affected me a great deal. But before then, I was his princess. He always made sure that he told me, maybe he knew what he was going to do, and let me know, whoever you're going to be with when you're older, they need to treat you like a princess. And you need to be that. And that's what you deserve. And so that's always what I sought out, was type of a fairy tale. And sometimes that works against us, I think, because after you've had that, you can create a fairy tale where there is none. You kind of miss little signs because you still see the sparkling tiara at the end of the road. It may seem like just now, at the end, I'm going to skip through life in these silver slippers and everything's going to be great. So the signs kind of, with this situation, went past my eyesight.
We both dated people that were a little shady in a lot of ways where we grew up at that time. There was almost like a code of ethics with those guys. They were doing whatever they were doing, but you treat women a certain way.
That's the thing. The people we knew, and even after high school, and we both ventured into our own lives, there was a certain thing that even if you're doing A, B, C, and D, you don't do A, B, and C, and D to me. I'm not worried about it. We may get in an argument, and even those guys, the street guys, we got in an argument, I was never called out of my name. And I'm thinking it's because I'm such a bad B. You know, you ain't stupid. You ain't gonna do that. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do. I have to take the onus off of myself. It has to do with that person and what lines they will cross. Not what did I do to make them cross those lines.
Well, and stereotypes. I mean, I think people stereotype like so much. And what I know, the people that you dated, you know, he was probably the cleanest cut even.
That's the problem. When I started dating him, and I met him at 11 years old, had a crush on him through my whole teenage years. So when this happened in our 40s, I'm like, oh, this is what's supposed to happen. And I remember clearly when I started dating him, my mother saying, don't mess this up. She doesn't even remember saying it. I remember her saying it. So whatever happens, I got to make this work.
That is powerful. And again, it's the stereotype, you know, oh, good, he's not a thug or drug dealer or whatever, you know, he's got a job, he's educated, whatever it is, he fit the stereotype of what she thought as a mom was better than what you'd been doing in the past, not understanding that those guys maybe weren't going to rule the world, but they also were kind.
Monsters come in all disguises.
So you knew him when you were young, and I have a theory, because one of the worst relationships I was in was somebody that I also met at 11. I don't know if we ever made that connection, by the way, Jamila. But I think that when you're an adolescent and you have your first feelings for somebody, that sort of imprint even makes you more likely to keep the rose-colored glasses on when you meet them later in life, because it's like kind of that 11.
I'm still seeing him as I did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. It took me a long time to get past that. So then it's social media, right? Like you're on social media and you're now an adult.
And I'm still close with his sister.
Okay.
At this time. Our parents were still close.
So you also had the trust of his family and knowing the type of people they were.
Yep.
And then who reached out? Did he reach out to you or did you reach out to him? How did that connection?
He reached out to me on Facebook after, I think he saw a picture of me and my mom, and he reached out and was like, oh my God, you still have the same smile. And it's those eyes. You know that. I'm like, now he has a crush on me. I had a crush on him all these years. Now he likes me. We did the whole inbox exchange numbers and started talking. And the first sign that I missed was, we had been talking. He came up for a birthday, my 40th birthday, I believe. Came up for a birthday. We argued on the phone, and I think I cursed. And he was like, you don't want to start that. And I was like, what? He said, you don't want to start that kind of relationship with me. I was like, what kind of relationship? You cursed at me. In my mind, it was just like, oh, he is so straight arrow. He doesn't like foul language. I didn't know he meant you about to release the beast.
It was a warning.
Yeah.
It's so interesting when you start looking back and looking at the red flags that you missed. How did that rest of that trip go?
After that, that was great. Then we did the DC to Philly thing, and he would come up almost every weekend. And then it was like he was looking for jobs up here. And my mom says he can't really find a job up here unless he can go on interviews. So he needs to come up here. So he moved up here. with me got a job within a week. That wasn't an issue. But we were working opposite shifts, which was perfect for me because I'm a space person. You work nights, I work days, our weekends are quality time. Little things like if we had disagreement, all of a sudden I was a bitch.
He used that verbiage.
Yeah. Or I wasn't as good as I thought I was. Nobody else wants me. I was hospitalized because of my diabetes at one time. My daughter took a picture of me in the hospital and was like, you know, keep prayers up for my mom. And he was irate. Kind of like, why do you want attention on you? I was like, it's not attention. I was in ICU. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I wasn't out there like Beyonce dancing.
Right. I was like, in hospital.
I was in ICU. But now all these dudes, I'm be like inboxing you and texting you.
Jealous.
And that's when the whole, he's going in my social media. I never close my stuff. I have nothing to hide. So I never hid. Because to me, if we're a couple, why do I need to hide passwords? But he went through my inbox through like years and found like 4 years before when one of my exes were texting each other and it wasn't even texting. It was just like lightweight stuff. And you want him, don't you? I was like, what are you talking about? He's married. We haven't been together in 5 years. Everything shifts, like something in him shifted to now, well, you got off at this time. Why weren't you home by this time? The little controlling thing.
How were you interpreting that at that time? Because I think we look back and it's like, why didn't I walk out at that moment or end it right then? How were you sort of justifying his behavior to in a way that you stayed with him?
Start to be a controlling thing. And like I said, I don't even know if I was interpreting it. I was just like, whatever. Because in my mind, you have nothing to worry about, so this ain't going nowhere. Your anger is stupid. It wasn't, I'm going to walk out. Because in my mind, this is who I'm going to be with. So this is what we need to move forward from and get over.
And you were engaged at this point, right?
The funniest thing is April 26, 2014, we announced on Facebook we were a couple. April 26, 2015 is when he assaulted me. We got engaged in a big thing. It was his parents' 60th anniversary, and we went to D.C. It was at a restaurant, and he did the whole on knee, you know, in front of like 20 people. And at that point, honestly, and this is where I say, that's why I don't trust myself and my choices, because I didn't want to say yes. And I said yes because of the festivities. I said yes because I felt pressured. I felt in the spotlight, and in my head, I'm going, I can say yes now, and then we can, I can break it off later. But I don't really want this. I don't want it, but I thought I was supposed to have it. That's what you're supposed to do as a woman, as a grown woman, supposed to be married.
Is it a subconscious lack of desire for actually saying yes, or were you consciously like listing out the things that had been going on that were
a gut? Mm-hmm. It was just a gut feeling. It wasn't like, oh, he did this, he did that. He did whatever. It was just something in my gut that didn't feel right. Of course, cameras are rolling, like all this stuff happened, and we drove up there together. And he lived with me back here.
So it was a complete surprise.
How do I say no? And what are we going to do, drive back in silence? It was like a bad movie where people are yelling at the screen, say no, say no. Don't go into the basement. And I was just like, okay, you didn't even see me going, oh my God. I was like, okay. It was ridiculous.
Well, and the thing is in a situation like that, it's such a new and foreign thing to happen to have such a big to-do, like that your family, even though they know you and they would normally be able to read you, they probably were thinking, oh my gosh, she's like completely in shock.
My mother and his mother are sitting next to each other like, now we're finally family. And my daughters and his daughters are hugging each other. And I'm like, oh, what the freak?
Well, this is why you actually should trust yourself, because your gut was on point. You just chose to not listen to it. At least it wasn't like you just skipped into it like, yay, this is, you know, you had something inside you was saying, giving you warning flags.
Oh, I wasn't Cinderella, like Ursula. That may write. And like I said, I didn't go with my first mind. And if I was who I am now, and it's sad that all that had to make me the person I am now. If I was who I am now, I'd have been like, yeah, let's talk about this, even in front of people.
Well, I think that's an important thing for people to know, is that even in that situation, even with the world watching, if your gut tells you not to do something, you do not have any obligation to anyone to do it.
Do it, and you have to be your authentic self. and not what anybody else expects you to be. Because nobody else was in that room. He was beating me half to death. All the people I was trying to make happy, they weren't there.
So you guys are at the event and then you drive back home. And what were the next couple months like? I mean, was he like happy and gentle and pulled back on the control a little, or?
The thing is that I think because when we were teenagers, he had substance issues that I wasn't aware of, because at that point I was with you guys. I wasn't with that part of my life anymore. I was with school people, with Chris Martin. You know, I was in a different world. I would hear things. Oh, they sent Colvin to rehab. And I'm like, well, you're 17. To me, if you're 17 now, you're 40-something. And you've been doing fine. I'm assuming you're fine. But no, he wasn't fine. We would have scrimmages, not even physical scrimmages, just vocal scrimmages at home, to the point where I'm like, I can't do this. And the amazing thing is that the morning that this happened, before he went to work, he didn't go to work that day. We had just bought a Lexus. Not because I wanted a Lexus, because he wanted to have a Lexus because people at his job had Lexus. You know I don't care about that stuff. If it runs, I'm happy. I don't care if the top is falling off. I'm cool. And I said I wanted to go to the grocery store. He said, and this is a control thing, he said, well, right now the car is in my name. So I'm not getting up. I worked last night. So you're not taking the car. So now I'm already pissed off. Fine. You know what? Took the cab to the grocery store, got food, came back, made dinner, whatever. I came home. He said, I apologize for everything I've ever said to you. I will never call you out your name again. This is that day. I don't know what happened between me and the store, but he said, I will never do that again. He said, your daughter said, and he was talking about Jai, he said, she told him, you call my mom bitch so much, I'm starting to think that's her first name. And he said, oh, that broke my heart when she said that. I will never call you out your name again. We starting over from today. He went out as I made dinner, had everything set, because I'm like a home person. I don't care if I'm mad at you or whatever. Dinner's going to be ready. We might not sit at the table together, but we're going to have dinner.
When you say out, like he went out to have drinks or friends or?
Exactly. I don't know. He went out and came back in and he was drinking some kind of dark liquor. You know, I'm not a liquor person. I don't know anything about liquor. I'm a beer person. If it's not like Guinness, that's only dark I know. I don't know that stuff. So I'm in the bed with the covers tucked under my legs, because that's what I do when I'm in the bed. It makes me feel secure. And I'm talking to my cousin on the phone, and he came in. I was talking about my daughter, something that happened with her. And I think he wrote hypocrite on a piece of paper, maybe because of what I was telling them about my daughter as opposed to how I actually reacted to my daughter. But he threw a note in there that said hypocrite, and it was spelled wrong.
You didn't laugh, did you?
Okay, yes. And I was still on the phone, and I'm like, okay, if you want to insult me, spell it right. That's the last thing I said. If you're going to insult me, spell it right. And he jumped on me, luckily, because of the thing I'm talking to you on now, the house phone, because I didn't have to, like, swish or do anything. And on the house phone, it has one button that you can push for 911. So as he starts hitting me, I hit that button, and he hung it up, and started beating me with the phone in my head. And I can't get out of the bed because my legs are tucked under.
Trapped yourself.
And I'm like trying to kick my legs out. 911 calls back. He answers the phone, but they hear me screaming, and they played the tape at court. Me screaming in the background saying, he's killing me. He's killing me. And he grabbed me, pulled me into the living room where I have this antique trunk, and started banging my head against the trunk and kicking me in my ribs. And he said, if they do come, they're going to find your dead body. It wasn't even like the me I know, we would have been going toe to toe. This was so unexpected.
The police bust in the door. He's still beating me as they come in. Like, he didn't stop until they grabbed him. As they're pulling him out and I'm still bleeding. And mind you, I didn't realize the intensity until I got home from the hospital 2 days later. And there's blood all over the walls, which is my blood. As they're taking him out, what he yells, and this is what started me crying because it's scary as hell. He said, I should have cut your throat a long time ago in your sleep when I wanted to. He's saying that as they're dragging him out. So how long was I laying next to that? Like, what?
The devil you know.
And I'm so glad my daughter wasn't there.
I was going to ask.
somebody would have been dead. He jumped on me. She would have cut him, or he would have hit her, and I would have cut him. Like, it would have been a whole thing.
So you end up in the hospital.
In the hospital with fractured skull, dislocated eye, broken ribs. They showed me him in the interrogation, like the video. And he's crazy. He's like, tell me that bitch still ain't alive. And that, like, crazy. They took me to one hospital, had to airlift me to the trauma center.
Wow.
And another hospital at Cooper, which, if you know anything about Jersey, Cooper is like the biggest hospital up here.
Obviously, there's whatever about him. But as far as the trigger that day, I mean, was it the drugs, in your opinion, or just like a mental illness?
I think it was both. I think he got a taste because at a point when we were in D.C., he left and went to see some friends. And he wasn't the same after we got back. He wasn't the same.
And then he wasn't the same again.
Mm-mm.
What do you have any idea what it was? Any guesses?
Well, he was on crack before, but that had been apparently years ago. And the funniest thing is when his ex-wife and him were friends on Facebook, he never told me anything about her. She found out we were friends. They showed the video of our engagement. She posted, just remember, your hands are for love, or something like that. And I was like, what does she mean? And he said, oh, she's Christian. And you know, Black Christians talk about putting your hands on people, and that's the hands of God. And he gave me all these excuses. I was clueless until he said, if I did anything to her, why would she be friends with me on Facebook? And that made sense to me. Maybe I'm stupid.
No.
That made sense to me. I didn't know until afterwards that he went to 3 years in jail for beating her.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that his family was aware of this, right?
His family, except for his sister, who I was friends with, she didn't know. When she left for college, she never came back. She was aware of her parents, but she wasn't aware of that. When my mother called his mother from the hospital, his mother broke down screaming, not Jamila. Not, I can't believe he did that. They kind of thought I was taking him off of their hands and I was a good influence. But you didn't tell me. Even if you say you can choose to stay or go, I'm going to tell you what's really going on.
How long did it take for you to heal physically from what he did?
Physically, a few months, because I was at work with sunglasses on because one of my eyes was swollen shut for like 3 weeks. Physically was a different thing. Mentally, I worked in a building on the 49th floor. I cannot be in the elevator with a man alone. I can be on an elevator with a crowd of people. That's fine.
Yeah.
If I got on the elevator with a man and I was by myself, my mind continuously went to, he could beat me half to death right now and nobody would know. Like, it could be a doctor. I don't care.
An elevator is also a very confined space. And it sounds like, yes, with what you did with the blanket,
yeah,
you were kind of in that confined space too. Well, one of the things that I think is really important for people to hear about Jamila is that even though you would think, as somebody who's never been in an abusive relationship, that surely after everything that you just described happened, you would be completely and totally done.
No.
And yet.
Because your mind, when your mind is broken and you're, I was convinced that, thank God, the take back only lasted like a week. Thank God. The problem with abuse is they spend so much time before hands are laid on you that they break down who you are. By that time, I had no clue who I was. And I was convinced nobody else would care. I might as well just do this. This is just who I'm going to be. And looking back, I can't believe I even thought that. But I did. When he got out, I was like, sure, you can come back here for a couple weeks and stay here. You know, he wrote me all these letters, and I was that dumb chick. I was her. I wish I was Farrah Fawcett in the burn of bed, lured him back there, and then set fire to the whole thing. I wish I was her. I can't even front like I was her. I wasn't her. When he came back, it was nice for a week until he grabbed my arm. He had to do nothing else. He grabbed my arm. 911, he got the go. And guess what? I still got a restraining order.
You still had an active restraining order from the first,
yep,
attack?
And I lived four doors down from the police department. So as soon as he grabbed my arm, I ran out the building in socks basketball shorts and a tank top. And it was winter. By the time they got there, he was gone. Of course, he had taken the ring so he could pawn and my Mac card so he could max it out to get wherever he needs to go. And he ran, because he was still out on bail. He ran back to Maryland. His parents wouldn't let him stay there, so he was sleeping on like a bench. Then he apparently, and this was of none of my doing, he came back up here. I had moved purposely. I moved to a whole nother city, but he knew where I worked. He came to my job, didn't come inside because downstairs in the building, they had his picture. He followed me the way I get home, followed me on the train, I guess hid out at the train station. I don't know what he did because he didn't get on the bus I got on. My complex was so big, he couldn't decipher which apartment was mine. Thank God, because the way the apartments are set up is like a dark hallway to get upstairs. He could have easily killed me. He was under like some business on the way to the bus stop. And I walk into the bus stop and I hear my name and I just start running. He starts chasing after me and he was like, "Where's your insulin? Where's your insulin?" Because you can overdose somebody on insulin. My cousin killed himself on insulin. So you can overdose on insulin. "Where's your insulin? You're taking me back to your apartment."
So he's not worried about you going into some kind of diabetic thing because you're running and scared whatever.
He was trying to kill me with the insulin. He was going to drag me back to my apartment, overdose me on insulin, and that's it. I just fought at that bus stop because I knew what time my bus was coming. And I was like, if I can fight him off for 3 more minutes, the bus will be here. When the bus got there, I'm yelling, "Help." The bus driver got out her seat, dragged me up on the bus. He ran. She stopped the bus, called the police. They took me to the station. And the police officer, he said, and it actually made me laugh, even though I was terrified as hell. He was like, "Oh, we found him. He was hiding under 18-wheeler, like most innocent men do."
Wow.
He was crazed when they brought him in, because they put him in a holding cell while they got my statement and took a video statement. And he's kicking and, "I'm gonna kill her." That was it.
I want to have Dr. Harris jump in.
Please
do. A lot. But I also think it's important for you to share how much time he actually did for this.
Got sentenced to 5 years, but he had time in holding. He got let out after 4 years. Which amazes me, because if this assault happened to somebody who was just walking down the street, see, they put domestic in front of stuff to make it seem like it's less than what it is. Assault is assault. If you fracture somebody's skull that you were trying to mug, you would get more time than 4 years.
Are either of you aware of whether or not there are organizations that are trying to change those laws at all? I mean, this surely has been something that has been an issue for many years. Maybe that's why we're meeting each other.
Aware at all, even as far as support groups. I mean, in my area, you have NAAA, you don't have DA. I mean, I'm thankful I have a good therapist and a good counselor. There should be support groups. There should be networks, not just things online that you can buy a t-shirt. "No more domestic violence." I don't need a damn t-shirt. I need help.
Well, and with everything in life, when you feel like you're alone in something that big, it makes it so much worse. And to know that there is a support group and to hear other people's stories, because like you said, "How I can't believe this would ever happen to me." It's what all of us said about you, Jamila. How could this happen to Jamila? She's the strongest one of all of us, but it matters not, you know? And if there's an organization where there's other women, it's like you learn that. Like, you could be weak, you could be strong, you can be tall, you can be short, you can be any race, you can be any religion. These men don't discriminate. It's something in them. It's not us.
And just to put something out there before we talk to the doctor, just for the masses, I had a lot of people who were really close to me who months, maybe a year later, came and said, because it took a lot for me to post that picture on New Year's.
Yeah, I will never forget it.
That was my coming out. Like, this happened. A lot of people fell back from me. And some of it was, "Well, maybe it was your fault." A couple of people even inboxed me later saying, I'm sorry I wasn't there for you. I just didn't know how to be there for you. I didn't know what to say, so I said nothing. Just saying I'm here and I care matters.
Yeah, and for, you know, everybody that is not aware, so Jamila posted the picture that was taken of her in the hospital, within 24 hours, right?
That was hours after it
happened. And, she's unrecognizable. It's a really, really, really hard picture to see for people. Those of us that love her, it's just excruciating, really. But she put it out there, and I admire you for doing that, because for every picture that goes up, there's probably 100 women that have looked like that or been in that situation and won't put it up. And so you might have done things for people in that moment that you have no idea by sharing that. Dr. Harris, I think it is important to hear from you about where this affects people like Jamila moving forward, as far as rediscovering that sense of self-worth again, you know, that, like Jamila said, she was being primed and conditioned leading up to that moment when he attacked. And so even worse maybe than the attack was everything he did to her that year as far as her self-esteem. How do you come back from that?
That's a hard question, because every woman or man, because men are also, you know, can be abused, have their own journey to that. I definitely think having a professional help, a counselor, a therapist, having a group of women or a support group is vital. And I think we need more of those support groups for domestic violence victims or overcomers. And just having community support is essential to recover from domestic violence. We need to have more support in our communities and professional help and support from our friends, our families, and, like I said, ultimately our communities. It needs to be a help from an array of people. It can't just be, right? It's a process. It's a journey for each person. Each traumatic incident that Jamila said is its own process to heal from. It sounds like multiple traumas. So we're not talking about one specific incident. We're talking about years of traumatic incidences. So each person's trauma and what they went through is going to be predictive of what their recovery and their healing process will be. But that's not an easy question answer.
Right.
It really isn't. I'm saying this off air. I'm still processing that. When Jamila, when she talked about, I guess what really hit me was when you said,
That's okay.
When she said, if I could just fight for 3 more minutes. And I hear that from so many women. And I hear so many stories of just pure humiliation that their abuser put them through. And I guess that just what she said just stuck with me. And how many women are just going to fight a little bit longer so they don't lose their lives. This just really hit me.
Honestly, the weird thing is, I wasn't thinking about if I can fight for 3 more minutes. Now I'm going to start crying out. It was like, my daughter can't find me like this. My mom can't find me like this. This can't be my end. It can't be. When I posted the picture, it was more about, this isn't my fault. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be ashamed. I shouldn't be the one who's hiding. I shouldn't be embarrassed. I should be putting it out there. Like, this happens to so many people. Like you said, men and women. This happens to so many people. You didn't ask for it. Somebody else's madness is not your responsibility.
One of the most disturbing, I don't know how you feel about this, Jamila, but the question that I'm not sure if you heard, but so many women tell me that they hear from other people is, why didn't you leave? That I want to ponder to our listeners. I would like to reframe that to, why did I stay or you stay? Because I think that love is such a powerful emotion, and there's so many factors that a woman or man stays, and it's, why did I stay? It could be morality. It could be a spiritual commitment to your partner. It could be the intense love that you have for someone, the children. It can be influences from your family, financial stress, mental health stress, or concern stereotypes that I should be married by now. So I think if we can figure out why people stay, we can really help communities to work together to support that person.
And it wasn't even why did I stay, it's why I let him come back. I didn't want to fail. And that may sound stupid. I didn't want to not make this work. It's harder in a time for women when you're doing Facebook and Twitter and you see all these wonderful relationships and these people who are just so happy and their lives are wonderful and they found the one they love. Why can't I make this work? When it's not your responsibility to make it work, it's your responsibility to take care of yourself. You got to make you work.
We've talked about that so much, Jamila, and it's such a different day and age. The thing that bothers me, and I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Harris, is not so much the people that are on social media that are genuinely happy and putting that out there, but the people that aren't and are putting up a facade in order to be perceived in a certain way. And so it skews the truth of how much happiness there is out there because half of it is complete bullshit.
I called my cousin yesterday. The biggest accomplishments, I was like, describe me before the abuse, then describe me after the abuse. I said, I'm just asking you this. Just describe both people. And she said, as Jessica may agree, you're still the caring, considerate, funny ass, cool person you were before. You're still that person. I'm just so guarded now. I'm very guarded. That did give me a blessing because I am stepping out now because I realized this is what I need to do. I bought a house after this.
Something you hadn't done before.
Oh, no. That was too permanent. That was too much commitment. I bought a car. My mother was like, you could have been bought a car. I bought a car and I bought a house. I'm getting my master's after next semester.
And talk to us about that. Tell us about where you're going to school, how you got the idea to do this, all of it. Tell us all of it.
Well, I'm going to Johns Hopkins and get my master's in fiction writing.
So you have always worked your butt off. I mean, you've always worked hard. You've always provided. You've never relied on anybody else. We pretty much supported the dumb boyfriends for years. But after all of this trauma, you end up actually getting laid off. So you're in a situation where you're at a crossroads, right? So you're trying to decide what the next path is.
When I got laid off, I was scared as hell because I had just bought a house. My granddaughter moved in. My mother moved in. But I'm the head of household. On a mortgage, I'm paying a mortgage, I'm doing all this. So when I got laid off because of COVID, I was scared shitless for maybe, I would say, 3 hours. Honestly. Then I was like, you know what? Screw this. What did I always want to do? I applied. They said, oh, that's fine. You just have to submit a 4,500 page essay about Wait, I thought I just had to apply. I didn't know I had to do something. I was like, okay, I'm not going to get accepted. It's not that deep. It's a master's program. I only got my undergrad. I'm not worried about it. And when I got accepted, I'm like, oh crap, I got to do this. And I started looking back on where I was when all of that trauma happened and where I am now. And I was like, man, my life is totally different because I'm looking forward into what my possibilities are, not what somebody else wants me to do, or not lowering myself so they won't feel intimidated, which is what was happening. Because we were, even when we were engaged, we were arguing about a house or a condo, I bought my house. How about that? How you like them notes? Now I found out you're living on people's couches. You're good. Do you? I got a grandbaby who I am practically raising. And that is one of the most invigorating things because I'm looking at a little woman coming up and I'm going to be able to teach her what you need to see. You can't teach everything, but nobody taught me this. I was never taught because I was never involved in growing up in an abusive relationship. My mom never had it. You know, I never knew what this was.
How do you plan to prepare her for the fact that this is something that is out there?
To let her know how she should be treated, what you accept and what you don't accept. And we're starting it in kindergarten, baby. We're starting it early. And life happens. And you don't know what's going to happen. But I was never in one, so I couldn't teach Jai what she was supposed to accept. Because I never had to accept anything less. You know, you teach them, not at, you know, in kindergarten, I'm teaching her, the boy who pulls your hair, stop sitting next to him.
Right.
We ain't doing that. That ain't cute. We teach kids, oh, that means they like you. No, move to another seat. We don't teach kids that. We teach kids certain things. It doesn't matter. Most people think abusive relationships, you came up in one, you saw one, and that's why you were involved in one. I never saw one. In any of my family, I never saw abusive relationships. So nobody ever taught me what somebody is supposed to talk to you, respect you like. So it's rearing the next generation.
It's so interesting that you say that you never experienced it. I don't remember any of our friends. The guys weren't like that. I don't think there were parents that were in those situations when we were coming up, but I was prepared for it. When I was a kid and when we still lived in San Francisco before we moved to DC, my mom actually volunteered at a domestic violence shelter. And it was one of those places that is a hidden location for women. Occasionally, she would be scheduled to volunteer at a time where she had to take me with her. And so I went to this place pretty regularly for a couple years as a very little kid. Like, you know, I mean, we moved to DC when I was 12, so it had to have been like 9, 10. And it had bars on the doors and it had like a steel door. I can remember what the face of this building looked like. And it's seared in my brain because I remember when people would show up and I remember them being escorted in. And sometimes it was late at night and sometimes they had little kids. And I just remember my mom saying, you know, we have to keep them safe and explaining everything to me. And I remember the fear that I had for these people and for us being there, because there were times where the men would show up and they would find out where these women were. But because my mom did that and because of the conversations we had, that was one of my you know, for me, it was cheating and putting your hand on me or trying to control me like that. And I had now there was a lot of other things people got away with. But I really think that because I had that experience, however like slightly traumatic it was as a kid, it probably helped educate me in a way that a lot of people wouldn't have had.
Yeah.
Or they're being educated in a way that is super traumatic because it's in their home. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mom, for that.
Dr. Harris, one question.
Sure. Yeah.
Trust.
How does she find it again, right?
Oh, how do you?
I don't have it, man.
How do you find trust?
I side eye old women in the grocery store.
She does.
What does she do? Trust
she side eyes everybody. She is side eye an 8-year-old little boy coming up too quick.
I want to get it back. I don't know how.
There are some specific types of therapy for trauma. So are you doing EMDR? Are you doing any type of specific therapy that works?
I'm doing specific therapy for PTSD.
Okay. Because it does matter. Yeah. We've talked about, Jess and I have talked about therapy. The type of therapy matters. That's a hard one. How do you regain trust? I think the biggest, one of the other things that stood out in our conversation is you saying, trust your gut. And we've talked about that too. So many times I haven't trust my gut and you just hear it in that intuition. Don't do it. Don't go there.
Yeah.
Don't go be with that guy. And you go against your gut. And I can't tell you how many times women will tell me that, just like you said, I didn't go with my gut feeling. The trust, I think it's going to be a process. You're talking about, again, trauma. And there is no time limit on grief and loss and trauma. There's no magical number within a year I'm going to be over this. I think with a good treatment and, like you said, trusting your gut and really starting over and noticing your gut intuitions, but also therapy and progressing one step at a time. Like it's a process, just like this happened for you. Domestic violence doesn't just happen like, oh, I met him and he smacked. Like in most cases, like you say, it's a gradual progression of degrading you. It's a process. It's a long process to really knock you down. So in the same aspect of recovery, it's going to take times that you feel like you're progressing and then you just step back, you regress, and then you advance again until that day that it does develop into your journey has come to the best recovery that you can have. But this is a process, just like the domestic violence was a process. And being, I think mindfulness is very helpful at just accepting where you're at in your journey and that it's okay that you're not trusting at this moment, but just really accepting your feeling and knowing that it's okay for you to have those feelings and one day you are going to be able to trust. I think it's important that you set out in the universe and with your positive thoughts that you are going to find this person that is going to respect you. And you constantly put that out in the universe. So anytime you might be at the grocery store and you have that incident of that 8-year-old sneaking up on you,
fine. Jessica said that.
What? Oh, Jess said that about the 8-year-old. But you throw it out in the universe that you are deserving of a person that's going to show you respect. You are going to find that person. And you just set your mind and also recovery from your body. And then with really good help recovering from the trauma, I think you're on your way. And support from other women.
And probably moving closer to me.
Yeah, she put that in there.
Here's something that I really think that we need to talk about, all three of us really, is why is there shame? Every woman that I know that's been in a domestic violence situation has used the word embarrassed. You said your mom can't see you like that. Jamila, your daughter can't see you like that. It's embarrassing to let people know. Is it the vulnerability of being in a position where somebody can do that to you? I mean, Erica's talked about
that. No, you feel stupid. It's not vulnerability. For me, maybe for other people, but for me, it's like, how stupid was I? That's what I felt
for
like.
For picking somebody that was capable of doing
it? Yes.
This?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for falling for it. That's just me. It wasn't a vulnerable thing. It was, what kind of dumbass am I? How did this happen?
Think about the women who are in marriages where this goes on and on and on and on for years. And friends will ask them, you know, what's going on? Like, why are you bruised again or whatever? And they're covering up and they're covering it up and they're lying to everybody for
because
so long.
Because they're embarrassed that that's the choice they made with a mate. They don't want anybody to say, I told you so. They don't want anybody to look down on their mate.
Yeah, because we're protective of them even when they're awful.
It's weird.
It is. Because
I've never felt shame. I've done stuff that I should feel shame for and I ain't do it. Right? I ain't feel shame.
I mean, it's a complete difference than if you got in a fight at a bar or, you know, you got in a fight with a friend in high school or something. Like,
being a victim is different than being an adversary.
Right.
Think about people who get raped. They feel ashamed.
Yeah.
They didn't do anything wrong, but they feel ashamed.
One of the things you had mentioned was the kind of closure. How can you have closure after this trauma and with him, frankly, walking the streets? I mean, how do you get there, Jamila?
I don't think there is closure for that. Closure means everything's tied up. Not tied up. I've reconciled with it. It's a different ball game now because now if you come up in my crib and my baby here, you gonna die. It's a different ball game than when I was by myself. Now I got something that I'm like mother bear, mother lion. Yes. I have a forever restraining order. That's good. But if you want to breach that, do your thing. Because now I'm back to Jimmy. Let her know who Jimmy is.
I might say what I thought in any situation strongly and loudly, but if it was with certain people, then I'd back up and let Jimmy step forward.
That's me. That's my
Okay. Jimmy's back.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie. People were afraid of her. There are legitimately
afraid.
There are legitimately people that might still actually be afraid. And it's not because she was doing anything. She's a buck 20, if that. And tiny little thing. It's just the mouth on her. It's the mouth on her. She'll take you down to your knees with just her.
You're scared.
Verbiage, not with the people that she loves. Jamila, what would you say to women that have perhaps been in a situation where there's been one episode of abuse and they have gotten the flowers and the apologies and the that'll never happen again? Do you think there's ever a time where somebody that's capable of violence? Yeah.
No, that's just me.
No, I'm think you're right. I'm wondering how you get through to women that are still in the place of buying into that idea that the things they love about this person will come back somehow and the things that are happening that are awful will magically go away.
I'm going to quote Maya Angelou. When people show you who they are, believe them the first time.
And I think the lesson for women that haven't gone through this to avoid going through this is the story you told about the engagement party. We have got to trust our instincts and not make excuses and not be in denial.
Trust your gut.
That's right.
When you see the signs that you don't even think are signs, you know they're signs, though. That's the thing. I knew they were signs. I ignored them.
Or also, don't you think when your friends come to you or your coworkers sit you down and say, you need to be worried about this, maybe you should listen to them too? Because several women will say they might not know the signs, but their friends or their coworkers or someone set them down and said, we're worried about you.
When that happens, don't get defensive. Listen. Don't get defensive of your man or your situation. Listen. You don't have to sit there and agree with them at that time, but ingest it.
One of our good friends, that's Erica Jamila, that's her boss, after seeing her come to work time and time. Erica was in an abusive relationship for 16 years, I think. And her boss pulled her in and said, look, enough. You know, I think she came in with a black eye and it was not the first time. And he said, enough. He basically said, he's going to kill you. And I think that you owe that. If you're an employer and you have an employee going through that, you better help them. You got to, if it's your neighbor.
Your coworker.
Right. Your coworker, like, your neighbor.
Your coworker, a neighbor, a friend, anyone.
Anyone, yes.
If you see something, like they say with the subways, if you see something, say something. They don't have to listen, but they're going to hear you.
Right.
They don't have to agree, but they're going to hear you. And it's going to go inside their soul. And they're going to know it's there. So when something happens, that's going to be like, oh, that's what Jessica said.
Or maybe you say it and you're ignored, and then somebody else says it and they're ignored, and then the third person says it and it finally registers. Mm-hmm. That's why we all owe it to each other.
We kind of have to be there for each other, even if they don't want us to be. Just say it. Don't worry about hurting somebody's feelings. Don't worry about if they're going to be upset that you said something about their man or their woman. Say it. Let the chips fall, but say it.
Yeah. And actually, Jamila, what happened with you, I forgot about this as part of this story, but what happened when Jamila led him back, it kind of started, the people that love her, you know, the most, all started a spider web of communication. And so her mom, her daughter, and some of her really good friends all started messaging and came up with a plan to actually remove Jamila and actually bring her here.
Oh, they were going to kidnap me.
We were going to basically kidnap her because we knew that he would never look here. But I mean, that's the kind of thing.
That's
like
love. That's we love you.
Yeah. That's the other thing, is sometimes the person's not ready to hear it, but you can have a plan as friends and loved ones. And
for a lot of families and couples, particularly that I work with, there has been evidence conducted that evaluates qualities in healthy partners. And then there's qualities that we see in unhealthy, or let's just say toxic relationships. The first is enmeshment, and that's in a partnership. You'll see that I think of like putting both my hands together and just like putting everything is so enmeshed. Like there are no boundaries between the two partners. There aren't individuality. So like one partner, if the other's gone for an hour to go out with their girlfriends, there's extreme duress because the relationship is so enmeshed. Like there is not individuality. There is not, oh, well, you go do your thing for your job, your career. I know you're going to be like, oh,
no, wait, I'm actually, I got a Word document open.
Before you finish that, when he first moved here, my girlfriend was having her 30th birthday and he was so upset we weren't dressing alike.
Oh, what?
I had my outfit. He had his outfit. He was like, wearing the same colors. And I'm like, no, when you just said that, that's what brought that back to my mind.
What it made me think of is the people that have a shared Facebook account.
Oh, yeah, I don't like that.
So another unhealthy quality is just poor or ineffective communications. You might get an argument and they might not talk to you for extended amount of time. So their communication can be indirect or unkind or one-sided. They might just voice their concern. In general, their communication is going to be unhealthy. So they have an unhealthy style to resolve conflicts or just unhealthy communication. One that I wasn't aware of is just in families too, but with partners especially, is comparison with others. Like, why aren't you like so-and-so? Mm. Like, why don't you look like that? Why don't you make the kind of money that so-and-so makes? So that comparison with other people, that's another way to kind of knock you down a little. Like,
well, and stop right there, because I have definitely heard relationships, people that I know, I've heard that. I've heard that dialogue. Can you imagine you saying that to your partner? Like,
yeah,
I mean, imagine comparing your partner. Like, if you turn it around and think about yourself doing that, it's like hideous. And yet we'll take that. We will take that from somebody else, even though the idea of saying that to them is so. So I think that's the other thing, is listen to these things and turn it the other way. For whatever reason, we care more about other people sometimes than ourselves. If you take it and you turn it, it makes it even more profound. At least that's what just happened to me.
Yeah. And it might not be just about you. It might be about maybe your property, or why do you have a car like that? It could be more just comparison about finances, material things, or your actual appearance.
Or so-and-so's wife does his laundry.
Yeah,
why
yeah.
you doing why don't my you laundry?
Yeah.
Why aren't why you don't ironing you? No, my yes, clothes? Yes.
This is hilarious that you guys are saying this, because the one person at my job who was able to bring some comedy into what happened to me, when he said it, it really resonated. I had my sunglasses on. This is after it happened. And everybody was scared to say anything to me. And Brian was like, so what's up with your dude? I said, he always wanted to be at the same level as the people that he dealt with. Friend bought a Toyota. So my fiance bought a Lexus. Mm-hmm. And he said, so his friend poked his girlfriend and he beat the shit out of you? And when he said that, I was sitting at the front desk and I like started laughing uncontrollably. Cause he was like, so he got to do everything better.
You know what I love about that though, Jamila, is that if you have a friend who's gone through something like this, or probably not a friend, but a coworker or a neighbor or somebody that you're not as close to, is that don't be afraid to like go up and just give somebody a hug or say, but just, I'm sorry this happened to you. Like, it's more uncomfortable to say nothing for you as somebody who's gone through that. For people to just sort of, it feels like you're being ignored and it feels weird, right? And the fact that he was able to joke with you,
that was the first time. Because everybody was like tiptoeing around.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And when he said that, I was like, I just burst out into laughter. I was like,
what was his name?
You're right. His name was Brian.
Props to Brian. Props to Brian for making her laugh at that moment.
Okay. The fourth one is exerting power. So power struggles. So they will try to exert, like I said, a sense of power. So it could be that they get power through their tone of voice, or maybe catch you off guard by throwing something or making all the decisions where to go to eat. Mm-hmm. But basically, they want to exert power over the relationship in any type of way. The next one is excessive criticism. So this is going to be, it may start as a little tease in front of people, or like a little teasing of your looks or your behaviors, or it can flat out become a direct comment or put down that can get more even verbally abusive. But that excessive criticism, it could be over something you cook, as simple as, oh, you burned that. You know, it starts like little teases and then it just gets downright probably into more like you're a bitch or something very like really bad. Mm-hmm. Another one is, the unpredictable interactions. You don't know if they're coming home at 5 o'clock, they're out with their friends for 2 hours. You're like, where are you? They might not answer your texts. They might put you on like airplane mode for a few hours. So there's no predictability with them or in their responses to your texts or your messages. Or some women will say like, he hasn't called me in a week, I don't know where he's at. So there's this unpredictability of their behaviors or interactions. You just can't predict them. Are they going to come home tonight and just like start screaming at me? So there isn't a predictability.
Which in contrast is they don't have any consistency because they're not capable of being consistent.
True. Yeah. And then there can be, they say, conditions for care. So instead of like an unconditional care and concern, there's conditions placed on love or caring. So like if you're sick, they may treat you different if you're not fulfilling their needs. But it's basically conditions
for love. Like if you're in the hospital.
Yes. Like if you're in the hospital, what are you doing? You want attention for that, right? And then a little to no intimacy. So they can withhold their affection or intimacy. Like they may restrain from giving you hugs or affection or intimate conversations. So they might become like passive aggressive or just not communicate with you verbally or also intimate, like affection. They can withhold their intimacy on purpose. One that I really should be aware of, but was less aware of, is this drug and alcohol abuse. And you mentioned it, Jamila, about the drug or alcohol abuse, but also something I just on the drive here was recognizing, like, I went out with someone that was an abuser and they were abstinent. And I didn't think in those moments, in those first 6 months, like, why aren't they drinking? Like, they're not drinking at all. And then eventually after 6 months, they were drinking everything, liquor, and then they became their true alcoholic self. So a red flag is, are they using drug or alcohol abuse, or are they abstaining? And why isn't that they don't? Do they just not want to drink? Maybe try to understand that more.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Part of the act.
Or are they dry sober? Dry sober is different than sober. Is I still have the need. I still want to do it, but I'm just not doing it. I'm not doing it for whatever reason, because maybe because I'm with you. But I do believe the taste got there when we went back to DC. Mm-hmm. When we came back home, the taste was already there. I don't know about like crack and stuff like that.
That was probably just the icing on the cake once you started.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then I think you did mention, Jamela, this lack of empathy, just overall, just not being able to really empathize, or I think over jealousy too falls in here with the lack of empathy or sympathy for you in times that you're injured or sick or just in general having a hard day at work. So just a total lack of any type of empathy. And then the last one is really excessive expectations that are unrealistic, expecting you to do everything perfect in the household, for example, cook, clean, you know, do unrealistic expectations and are very hard on you if you don't meet their expectations according to what they think you should be doing. Those are the main ones that I found in research. I'd like women or men to be aware of these. So if they happen to fall into some of these qualities, it might be a way to kind of step back from the relationship and think through it a little more clear.
Were there any of those that weren't a yes for behaviors from him, Jamela?
Seem like it was all
right.
I was gonna say.
She's reading them, and I'm like,
I know. I was checking all of them when she was talking. I'm like, yep, there it is. There it is.
How about we add this into a manuscript for young girls when they're like in middle school? That checklist right there.
Yeah.
All right, Jamela.
I gotta tell you.
Okay. First of all, you know how proud I am of you for going back and getting your master's, and I know you're gonna be a brilliant writer. You already are. But one thing that I don't think you maybe know that I found out recently is that some of the most successful people in the world are people who lost a parent as a child. There are more presidents and leaders and writers who've lost a parent, and they call it the eminent orphan syndrome. And so these are people who psychologists say that trauma at an early age is a propellant that sends them propelling into life because they're more on their own. They have a focus to persist, to invent, to chart their own way. And so we didn't really talk about what happened with your dad, but just so you know, I feel like he left and he kind of gifted you with this thing that people don't know about. The only reason I know is because this happened to my stepson losing his mom, and I talked to a writer, and the writer actually told me, here is something positive. There's also a level of emotional depth that you reach much younger when you experience something so emotional that other kids are sort of sheltered from. And so they're tapped into thinking about the world in a different way, and they're deeper and they're more driven. And that's why I know that the book with my name in it is gonna end up being on all the shelves.
Okay. Oh, yeah. You know what? Oh, get over your name. Get over your name, dog. Get over your name, homie.
I'm she's getting a little up there, like confident with this book.
Doctor,
yeah.
I didn't even realize I put Jessica as the main character.
She did it. That's the funny thing.
What?
But you know, subconsciously.
Oh yeah, it's all subconscious.
I didn't even know. I was like, oh my God. Okay. The main character is Jessica. Just so you know.
Thank you for telling us your story. I love you. Thank you, Jamela. Thanks for being on Flip Flops and Tierras.
Love you.
We love you.
Ta-ta for now. Thanks for listening to Flip Flops and Tierras. We would love to hear your story. Send us a message online at flipflopsandtierras.com or visit us at Flip Flops and Tierras on Facebook or Instagram. Dr. Harris has a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology with over 13 years experience as a licensed professional counselor. She's also the CEO of Individual and Employee Wellness, which is a wellness center that serves all dimensions of wellness.